Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/double. A better web starts with your website.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, May 29th, the hashtag edition. I'm June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ section, and I'm sitting in the hosting chair this week because Hannah Rosen is locked in a room somewhere typing like a maniac. That means that the three of us who'll be yakking today are all in the Slate New York studio. The other two women sitting in the room with me being Slate senior editor Jessica Winter. Hello, Jessica.
Hello, June.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hello, Noreen.
Hi, June.
Before we get started, I just want to remind listeners that we have an email address where you can send comments, questions, and expressions of appreciation and outrage. That address is xxgabfest@slate.com. After our last show, we got a bunch of emails about baby names, one of them from a woman named Clover Nyberg, and Clover is now my favorite name.
It's a great name.
Yes, it was. Well, after June, of course, that's my favourite name. May Fallon pointed out that I had lacked empathy with Monica Lewinsky, and I fear she was right about that. And I apologise, Monica, if you're listening. We're still getting email about basic bitches, some of it because people like to hear us say those words. So, Noreen, Jessica, maybe just a quick basic bitch.
Noreen, are you a basic bitch?
I'm a bad bitch.
Even better.
I agree with that assessment.
I'm also pleased to report that people are writing in to say that they're enjoying Srugim, or as Hannah might say, Srugim. And for those of us who are asking how to spell it, it's S-R-U-G-I-M. And if you ever need more information about the stories and the items that we discuss on the podcast, you can find that information on our show page. Now we have a new URL that will help you find it. That's slate.com/XX. Slate.com/XX. Thanks again to everyone who wrote in, and please do let us know what you think of the show. The address is xxgabfest@slate.com. Okay, our three topics for today are first, the hashtag YesAllWomen and the social media response to Elliot Rodgers' murder spree last Friday. Second, we'll talk about paid menstrual leave and whether it's an inalienable right for American women. Finally, we'll discuss Sophia Amoruso, her online fashion business Nasty Gal, and her book hashtag girlboss. Yes, the hashtag is part of the title, which is a real pain in my patootie. Okay, our first topic is Yes, All Women and the response to a terrible act of mass violence. Last Friday night, 22-year-old Elliot Rodger killed 6 people and injured 13 more in Isla Vista, California, and then apparently took his own life. He left behind a manifesto saying that he did it because women wouldn't sleep with him. The raw misogyny in the materials he left behind was shocking and appalling, and in the days that followed, many women took to social media in response to a hashtag not all men, which is sometimes used as a counterpoint to feminist arguments, but wasn't necessarily used that way in this case. The hashtag yes, all women really took off. There were more than 1 million tweets with that hashtag over the course of the weekend. Some of the tweets in question were, I have a boyfriend is the easiest way to get a man to leave you alone because he respects another man more than you. Yes, all women. Because every single woman I know has a story about a man feeling entitled to access to her body. Every single one. I shouldn't have to hold my car keys in hand like a weapon and check over my shoulder every few seconds when I walk at night. Girls grow up knowing that it's safer to give a fake phone number than to turn a guy down. Yes, all women. Jessica, what's going on here? Why do you think this hashtag took off like it did?
I think it took off in part because, well, I think it took off because people were trying to make sense of this senseless incident. And I think sometimes when these really awful incidents of gun violence happen, and they happen all the time in America, there isn't much point maybe in interrogating the intentions of whatever madman perpetrated these crimes. And maybe that's the case in this instance, too. In fact, Mike Pesca talked about this in the Gist just yesterday about how much attention we should really be focusing on this killer. Mm-hmm. But I think what people were thinking about was how this killer's, you know, crazed, deranged thoughts about women, his entitlement to women, his entitlement to women's attention, existed on the extreme end of a continuum, with the other end of that continuum being the men on the street who ask you to smile and then, you know, shout epithets at you if you don't smile back, or, you know, the men in the subway who rub against you, and if you back away, they talk about how you're dressed in such a way that might invite that kind of attention. That whatever part of the continuum that you're on, there are men, as expressed in the tweets, who are assuming control over you or thinking that they can assume control over you. And I think this really released a pressure valve for a lot of women who could just express these things in a relatively safe space. And it was also really striking to me how surprising these stories were to very progressive-minded, feminist-minded men who seemed genuinely taken aback at the sheer amount of defensive mechanisms and just emotional maintenance work that a lot of women, maybe particularly young women, but women in general, have conditioned themselves to have just to get through any given day.
Yeah, when I was reading those tweets, I tend to not think of myself as someone who thinks overly about men as potential attackers or whatever. And I was reading the tweets and I was like, oh, I do a lot of these mm-hmm, things. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize it. You know, I didn't even think about these as defense mechanisms. These are just like built-in things that happen. And that was, so I was even a little surprised as someone who does those things and experiences those things.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's so knit into the fabric of everyday life that you don't even think about it mm-hmm. as a woman necessarily.
However, I will say, I wish that this hashtag, I wish that it were somewhat separate from the UC Santa Barbara thing. I think it's a little problematic to take an event like a mass killing and to then turn it into this discussion, which I think is worthy, and the explanation that Jessica gave of it existing on a continuum does absolutely make sense. But there is a way in which it feels a little inappropriate to turn the deaths of a number of people into a discussion of, you know, it's really annoying when men tell me to smile on the street. And I know that it's, you know, that is one tweet that's part of a larger mm-hmm. statement that people are making, and it's a quilt that is made up of a bunch of different ones, but there is something a little bit, it felt a little bit narcissistic to me to read tweets of women being like, men harass me all the time. It just felt like the wrong moment to be having, not the wrong moment to be having this conversation, because maybe there's never a wrong moment to have that conversation, but as a direct response to the UC Santa Barbara shooting, it was a little problematic for me. Like, I think that we are, in this instance, we're having this discussion because we're sick of having the conversation about video games, we're sick of having the conversation about guns, we're sick of having the conversation about what it is that happens to men of a certain age that makes them so angry. I mean, maybe this is part of what makes them so angry, but it just feels like in these instances we want there to be an easy cause-effect, and this was sort of a new one. I mean, there hadn't been, I think in 1989 or something, there was a shooter who killed a bunch of people, including women, and said that it was, you know, he was angry at the feminists. But it really has been a long time since there's been something like this where it was so specifically tied to misogyny. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be having this conversation, but something about the hashtag mm-hmm. and the way the hashtag worked felt a little facile to me.
I agree with that. There was something about it that made me uncomfortable, and I didn't quite know how to articulate it. And I think you just did. It almost felt as though this incident was not being hijacked, but it was being diverted somehow. I think the fact of the matter is we're always straining for something to talk about, something to release what we're feeling when this happens. And yeah, the tragedy, you know, the underlying tragedy of many, many tragedies born up in this is that we are sick about talking about gun control. Mm-hmm. Because after Newtown happened, it was like, this is it. We're going to get gun control now. Like, out of all this obscene chaos and horror, we're going to get gun control now. And we didn't. And I think a lot of people, myself included, gave up after that. That gun control is not going to happen in my lifetime. But maybe attitudes toward women might evolve more in my lifetime. So let's talk about that. I mean, maybe that was the sort of coping process that people were going through that, in part, produced this campaign.
Well, it's interesting that one of you used the word pressure valve. You know, it released some pressure. It was a way that people could express themselves somehow and find some way of just perhaps, I don't know if it was making sense, but just making some connection. I take the point that it does seem kind of narcissistic. Where it seems to me that it may have paid off, although I'm a little skeptical, is in the way that men seem to have kind of gotten something. You know, seeing a lot of people tweeted or said that seeing the, as I said, more than a million tweets, seeing them all somehow, you know, made them realize how much or the extent to which women, you know, have these feelings of living in a misogynistic culture, which is not necessarily a widely held opinion most of the time. Some of the male shock did seem a little performative to me. you know, it did seem like there was something to that. Am I just being a basic bitch to make that claim that it was a little bit of performance going on?
No, I did have, I mean, partly this is because I'm someone who spends a lot of time on the internet and all internet. There's just a cycle that you see over and over again with every news event. But it was sort of like, okay, the news event happened, and then one group sort of seized on it in a pretty righteous manner. And then another group was like, well, you're offending us. And then still another group, that, you know, like right-thinking men were like, no, we're on your side, women. And then other people were like, not all women. Like, there were just a million proliferating hashtags, and everyone was arguing, and everyone just was seeking the moral high ground.
Right.
And it was like, I don't know, there are 7 people dead in Santa Barbara, and now I'm seeking the moral high ground. See how that works? But still, there was something a little bit exhausting to me. I don't want to discount the fact that people really may have learned something from it. Because again, I think I actually, despite being a little turned off by the whole thing, did learn something about myself. So
I think one thing that I discovered through this that did not make me feel slightly uneasy as the Twitter campaign did was there's a Tumblr called When Women Refuse. It chronicles relatively recent incidents of women being beaten, maimed, shot, tortured, killed for such things as refusing to have sex with their male partners, breaking up with their male partners, filing a restraining order, filing divorce papers. It's a very grim feed. But it's true that if you spend some time on that feed, you might think less and less of Elliot Rodger as an isolated incidence of madness, as a lot of people are still depicting it, and maybe rightly so. And you start viewing it more as a larger cultural issue of misogynist violence. I don't know if I saw this first on When Women Refuse. No, I wouldn't have. But it got buried in the news cycle. On Friday afternoon, the Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice held a press conference with his wife, Janae, who he beat unconscious in an elevator. There's security footage of it, and there's footage of him dragging her out of the elevator. And he apologized for, quote-unquote, the situation my wife and I were in, unquote. And Janae Rice also apologized for the role that she played the night of the incident. I haven't really seen this played up outside of sports blogs. You know, it's not a mass shooting. It's not a mass killing. Mm-hmm. It is not what happened in California. But it's just one more example of how normalized misogynist violence and violence against women is. It's as normalized as gun violence. That really got me thinking.
Yeah. You know, funnily enough, I heard that press conference and a kind of negative or angry response to it on sports radio on Friday, so which was actually kind of pleased me. Not, I mean, because it is horrifically tin-eared, but also that, you know, a dude on sports radio was, you know, pointing out that he clearly didn't understand what he had done, and really that there was much wrong with the way that he'd treated his wife.
Well, that's heartening.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, sports radio isn't a, you know, it's not necessarily a fertile valley of feminist thought.
I think, I mean, part of it is that we are all in this discussion sort of operating from the sort of position that all base male instincts are bad. But, you know, honor and that kind of thing are also male instincts, too. So maybe those sports talk radio hosts had more of a sense of honor and right and wrong than that athlete whose name I've already forgotten. That's how horrible.
Good.
Ray Rice.
Noreen, in our last episode, we talked about the Bring Back Our Girls hashtag that had been part of the response to the kidnapping of the Nigerian students. We do seem to be in a moment of hashtag activism. Is it just a huge waste of time, do you think, or might it actually be productive?
I am inclined to think it's a huge waste of time that makes people feel better. It makes them feel like they're participating in solving the world's problems when they aren't really, but maybe that's not so bad. It's certainly like not doing any harm for someone to feel involved in this cause, and maybe it'll lead to, you know, them donating funds or something that could have an actual impact in the real world. I mean, in the case of Bring Back Our Girls, it does seem like it got the attention of the White House, mm-hmm. and that spurred real action. But I don't think that hashtag activism is the future of solving the world's problems personally.
It might be the future, though. I mean, it's true, it doesn't seem to lead to solutions, but on the other hand, solutions are really complicated anyway. And so, you know, that's the hard part. At least people maybe get engaged, get enraged. And so, even though I agree it doesn't actually achieve much, it's better than nothing.
Well, am I totally cynical for thinking that a large part of what people want when they, you know, add the hashtag is that sort of pat on the back, like, you're a good person, like, you care about
absolutely.
The girls, and I just, there's something in me that can't get beyond feeling a little grossed out by that.
I've had that feeling where I've hit retweet on something and just thought, oh, I retweeted that so that I can show that I'm a good person. And showing that you're a good person is not the same as solidarity. Yeah. Is something that actually requires effort and possibly risk. And mm-hmm. this is the opposite of effort and risk. It doesn't make it a bad thing, like you said, Noreen. It doesn't cause any harm, but it doesn't do much more than not cause harm.
it's a pretty low bar for entry to be involved in a movement right now.
Right.
All right. This episode of the XX Gabfest is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy and fast to create your own professional website, portfolio, and even online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/double and use the offer code double. I'm still messing with my Squarespace site because I just can't stop dragging and dropping.
This is going to be like the Mona Lisa of websites.
It's going to be
out.
The greatest website. I'm going to send an email to the world, like, check out this website. It's the greatest website because there's been so much dragging and dropping. Because that's the thing with Squarespace. You can just drag things and then you can drop things.
But you can do it more easily and quickly than June Thomas is doing it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
How long have you been working on your website?
I would say about 18 months, although actively paying the bill is the thing that I do is the only thing I could really describe as activism. Occasionally I'll make a list of, you know what, I really should highlight my ex, and then there's just so many amazing aspects of June to highlight,
right?
That obviously it's
of course
pretty tricky job, but you really can drag and drop everything.
Is there a dental section?
No, you know it.
Yay.
There's a growing dental section. Okay, so the Squarespace site, we're not really giving it its due because it is extremely usable. The designs are gorgeous. And of course, Squarespace is famously conscious of responsive design. So when you come up with a layout that looks good, when you finish dragging and dropping, if it looks good on your main computer screen, you can be sure that it will also be viewable and look goodable on a smaller tablet or phone screen. You can start a trial and start building your new website today, no credit card needed. When you do decide to sign up to Squarespace, plans start at $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. When the time comes, be sure to use the offer code DOUBLE to get 10% off your first purchase and to support the XX Gabfest. We thank Squarespace for their support. Now let's talk about periods. There's been some chatter, admittedly mostly in the kinds of places where people have to find things to chatter about on a regular basis, about paid menstrual leave. In Japan, a 1947 law allows women to take leave when they're experiencing painful periods. In South Korea, as of 2004, Women can take a day each month to consider their ovaries. And in Taiwan, women get 3 days of period leave per year. In Indonesia, 2 days per month. Katie Waldman had a great piece in Slate saying that American women don't need it, period. But Jessica, do you think Katie's right? Or should women get extra time off work during their bleeding years?
Let's use as many euphemisms for period as we can during this topic.
I am basically with Katie on this, but like anything else, we all come at this from a subjective point of view. So something like 1 in 5 women experience debilitating premenstrual and menstrual symptoms. The other 4 in 5, you know, they take a Motrin, they affect a stance of grim stoicism, and then they just push through. And so how you look at this might depend on which of those camps you fall into. If you are in that 1 in 5, I can see how those women would want to demand specific, reasonable accommodation for what they experience. But I think even taking that into account, and Katie's piece goes into this, you could just fold it into a reasonable and humane national sick leave policy. But of course, the U.S. lags behind most of the developed world on sick leave, just as we lag behind most of the developed world on pretty much any measure of public health, women's health, reproductive health.
Do you guys think it's bad for women and for feminism to even discuss the idea that you might, your work might in any way be impaired by your monthly period?
I don't. See, I think that I understand why it happened, but somehow the way that women entered the workforce erased differences. And the fact is, you know, 20% is actually kind of a lot. And we never talk about, I've never had a conversation about periods in the office. And we don't even, I don't know about you guys, but I don't even really talk about periods with other women. And it is a thing. I think if men had periods, we would be hearing about it constantly. And I do think it's an odd, it's odd that we, you know, most of us have at least some discomfort. And it's, we just, we stay absolutely silent about it.
So you think people should talk about it more?
I kind of do. I mean, it reminds me in the 70s, Germaine Greer famously in The Female Eunuch said, if you think you are emancipated, you might consider the idea of tasting your own menstrual blood. If it makes you sick, you've got a long way to go, baby. I mean, that it has always been like just a topic that isn't given any consideration.
Okay. I am one of the 4 in 5. I am lucky. But I think every lady once in a while just has a bad month. You know, or maybe I'm presuming too much, but I remember one time I took a sick day for a bad month. And the next day I came in and a woman who, you know, she definitely outranked me. She was older than me. She was not a peer. One of my favorite colleagues I've ever worked with. And I'm not naming her because I don't know whether she wants to be associated with me shedding my uterine lining. She stopped by and she said, oh, I heard you were sick yesterday. How are you feeling? And I said, oh, I'm feeling much better. And she said, oh, was it a stomach thing? And, you know, just very well-meaning, lovely. And I couldn't lie to this lovely woman. And I just looked at her and I said, I had my monthly concern. And I'll never forget her reaction because, you know, her eyes got kind of wide and she was definitely a little taken aback that I was talking to her about my period, but she recovered and she ended up talking to me about how recently she and her 2 daughters had all gotten it at the same time and they were all baying at the moon and her husband had to, you know, retreat into the woods and live in a tree until it all blew over. And it was just, there was just something really nice about 2 women in the workplace in their high heels admitting to each other that they have functioning bodies. Maybe it was a little gross, but it's weirdly this nice memory.
But it's not gross, right? Why do we think it's gross? I mean,
it's gross.
It's
we're talking about it is not gross. I mean, the thing itself is not really ungross. See, one thing about menstruation in the workplace that I think deserves maybe more discussion is just, I think if the worst nightmare or the worst experience I had in the office is about like accidents, you know, stains or flooding situations or things like that, because then like you're just, it's not just about being at work, it's just, there's not a sort of thing you want to happen anyway, but certainly not in public. But even then, I don't think, I remember once bringing it up in my van pool because, you know, there was something like, ah, shit.
You brought it up You brought it up where?
In my van pool. But Jessica, you're so lucky not to have experienced my discussion of van pool.
Have you explained it on the Double X Gab Fest before?
Do people not know what van pools are?
No.
June,
You're the only person I know because I've known you for years. You're literally the only person I've ever... It's like a carpool. But June had one in Seattle.
Exactly.
That was very
important. Seattle, the city actually provides you with a van and lets you keep it and you drive around in it and those people become your best buds and, you go through life together.
So in this socialist paradise, you guys all talked about your periods regularly.
Exactly. Well, and so one day, because we were very close, I did, I had to say, oh, this just happened. And I swear the men in the van pool who, knew all our problems and joys were sort of like, oh, my God. And they were not offended or anything like that, but just kind of, how do you guys go through life like this?
Well, I feel like the bodily reality of it, men with wives or girlfriends or sisters sort of know about the bodily reality. That is maybe less where in our emails beforehand, June, you referred to this as the feminist third rail, talking about menstruation. We were like, yeah, let's go touch that third rail. But I think one of the reasons that it is the feminist third rail isn't necessarily, partly it's the gooiness of the whole thing, but that was really gross. Just touching that third rail. But it's also the idea that in less enlightened times, there was the idea that women wouldn't be able to make, there couldn't be a woman president because once a month she'd be like off her head. She'd be so angry and weepy and sad. And I feel like that's actually the more pernicious stereotype about women and periods. It's like on every terrible CBS sitcom, there's a joke about someone having her period and being really angry and making bad decisions. And I think that's actually like, if there were to be, not that there ever will be, paid menstrual leave, it would really just be opening up the door to legitimizing that concern.
But do premenstrual syndromes actually affect your decision-making, or do they just affect your affect? You're making the same decisions. You might be a little snappish or a little, I don't know. I don't want to make any generalizations about what women are like when they have their period. But
yeah, I think everyone's different. I mean,
yeah,
I want to quit my job every time. I'm like, everything's just so bad. I'm so bad at my job. I just don't know. And then 2 days
But you
later,
do your job, sure. And you keep your job, and everything kind of
I have
rolls
to say,
along. Right?
The times when I think I might have endangered my career most have been when I was just, I had no buffer, and I just was not going to just kind of go, okay, when I was criticized, and I just thought, oh man, if I don't keep a lid on this, things are going to escalate. But at the same time, that just shows maybe that I'm stuffing things down that I should be expressing.
But I think that can go either way. A friend of mine a few years ago told me this story of at work, they were just piling more work and piling more work and piling more work on her. And she went to an early morning meeting one day when she was really PMSing pretty hard. And, they introduced this other project that, they expected her to take on, and she freaked out. And freaking out was this awesome thing to have happened because she ended up getting the budget to hire more people. And she ended up with less work and a much more humane, family-friendly work environment because she PMS'd all over a meeting. I mean,
this is a feminist fairy tale. That's
it is.
Amazing.
And, I think listeners should write in with their own tales of PMS triumphs. But I think it can go either way. Maybe, I don't know, am I being naive about that?
No, not at all. I mean, I think I was just raising the question. I don't actually believe that women are delegitimized or out of their heads when they are menstruating,
and I do
for
think,
the record.
And I do think that we just need more sick leave generally, right? I mean, it's just the point that you started with, Jessica, that it's one thing to say, well, we don't need special leave because we can just take sick leave. And there are a lot of places where even if you have sick leave, there's an attitude when you get back of like, you take a lot of time off it's often not sort of encouraged to really take the leave that you're entitled to.
And there are, I don't think we mentioned it, but Jessica talked about the 1 in 5 women who have a really rough time, but there is an even smaller subset of women who become actually clinically depressed during menstruation. I think it's called PMDD. I mean, you can't really be on depression medication if it's just, five days a month. So there are women for whom it is not just, super, super unpleasant. It's actually like a change in your chemistry. And, I don't know how that would or should be addressed. But that seems, I mean, my heart goes out to them, I guess, really, is the only thing I have to say.
All right. Well, I wonder if I'm displaying a terribly old-fashioned or diminished kind of sexism on my part to wonder if all our male listeners clicked the next button during that segment. men, tell us if you have views on menstruation. Would you like us to have more conversations about periods? Write to us at xxgabfest@slate.com. Listeners, I just want to take a moment now to remind you about Slate Plus. Slate has this new program as of a few weeks ago where for $5 a month or $50 a year, you can get all kinds of extras. Among the many awesome things that you will get if you join Slate Plus are some special podcasts, including a weekly discussion of Game of Thrones, which is typically between our great TV critic Willa Paskin and Dan Coyce. Willa also spoke with Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields, the showrunners of The Americans, the great FX show about spies among us in the 1980s. And at the end of every week on Fridays, there's an email from one of the Slate editors or writers telling you about their favorite things from Slate during the week. And that is a really fun way of experiencing the magazine. So if you are interested in joining Slate Plus, go to slate.com/XXplus. All right, on to our final topic, which is Sofia Amoruso, the founder and CEO of the 7-year-old online fashion site nastygal.com. She has a new book out this month called #girlboss. And yes, annoyingly, the hashtag is part of the title. Noreen, I confess I hadn't heard of Amoruso or her company or her book until you sent us a link to a great profile by Molly Young in New York Magazine. Not a bad magazine, that magazine.
Not bad.
And now I think she's the coolest capitalist ever. Tell us about Amoruso and her company.
So her company is called Nasty Gal, which I personally think is an unfortunate bit of branding that she should have dumped a while ago, but it's from a Bette Davis song, I believe, or no.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
She is 30 years old. She was sort of a misfit growing up. She didn't do particularly well in school. She was diagnosed with depression and ADD. She didn't really go to college. She lived as an anarchist and a freegan, and she shoplifted. And then when she was maybe 20 or 22 or so, she began selling clothes on eBay, and she was vintage clothes on eBay, and she had a real eye for it. She styled everything just so, and it was, you know, the cool girls and tattoos who had asymmetrical bangs and you wanted to look like them. And she really built her business on MySpace and eBay, which is sort of, you know, that's not so long ago, but it sounds so dated. Anyway, and then it became a standalone site, and now I believe it makes new clothes, and venture capitalists came in, and it's a massive, massive business now. So she has written this book, Girl Boss, about she, in some of the press, including in Molly's article, she has taken little digs at Sheryl Sandberg, who obviously Lean In was last year's big, you know, woman in the workplace how-to book. And Sofia Amoruso seems to be styling herself in opposition to Sheryl Sandberg. She's saying, you don't have to have all these credentials. You don't have to have this planned out. You don't need these, like, mentor figures. You just have to have, you need to work really hard and know what you want and be pretty aggressive about getting it. But you don't need to follow these other things. I mean, even, like, the title seems like an answer to Lean In. It's like, no, like, you're a girl and you're the boss. You don't have to sacrifice. You don't have to sort of play this game in order to get there. You just do your thing and if you, again, like, work hard and are smart about it, you can sort of bend the workplace to your will, not bend yourself to the workplace as well. So I actually, have you guys read the book?
I have not. I did.
We only decided on this yesterday.
I did take a look, though, and it the way that it was written is very, like, page-turny.
Yeah.
She does have a brand, and it is, like, yes, she's a community college dropout, but it's all about working hard. It's about anyone can do it. You don't have to, like you say, you don't have to have credentials, but you also, you know, you don't have to have gone to the Ivy League. If you didn't go to an Ivy League school, it doesn't mean that you're going to be a failure. Mm-hmm. And I can see that that is really encouraging and really, like, thank God that's the message, because I didn't go to an Ivy League school.
And here you are on yeah. the podcast.
Well, most more people didn't than did, I guess.
That is for sure. I just read a little bit of it yesterday and today, so I haven't gotten all the way through it. But what I will say is that I think that she's very good at branding herself. And she talks about why her eBay shop was successful. And she says, you know, I styled the clothes in the shoots. People didn't do that. But I like made sure there was like a way that people wanted to look. And you sort of like wanted to be the girl in these photo shoots. And that's sort of what her book is like. I mean, she has been very canny about realizing, you know, that there's a place for someone to come in and be like, I'm the millennial girl boss. Like, I'm okay with the word girl. I think it's like, I'm like reclaiming the word girl. Don't tell me I'm a woman. I'm a girl. You know, I can wear cute clothes and be the boss. I didn't mean to diminish in any way what she's done, but she is sort of saying that. That is a large part of her argument. But there's a whole section in the part that I've gotten through on her years as a shoplifting anarchist. And she talks a lot about how it was for political reasons and how she can't believe now that she's this big capitalist with however much, you know, whatever her valuation is. But it struck me that there's actually not that far of a difference between someone who like will take anything she wants, whatever the cost, and someone who runs a big company. So that's just my tiny observation about her mindset.
I mean, one of her anecdotes is the first item of clothing she ever sold on eBay was stolen. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. Or no, it was the first, I don't know if it was the first item of clothing. I think it was like, the first thing she ever sold on the internet was a book she stole.
Oh, okay.
And sold it on Amazon.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean that.
I was embroidering the story to make it sound better. I was branding it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like, it's like a pretty raw capitalist spirit that, you know, she saw at the time as anarchist freegan. But I don't know. I think that.
I mean, it all just adds to her relatability, right? I mean, the fact that she did really use these analytics in a way that, you know, now we think of, well, you need a huge database, you need, you know, programmers, you need to have learned all this stuff about, you know, computers and SQL servers or pivot tables or whatever. And she did it in a very lo-fi way. I mean, she looked at what got more hits and what put the price up, and then she took the photos like that, you know, and there's something very encouraging. Honestly, I have nothing in common with her except maybe ovaries, and yet I want to be her. I mean, it is a fantastic bit of branding. It's a really encouraging story, kind of, right? Or am I falling too much for her sell?
Well, I don't know. I think I was not quite as sold as you are. Part of it is that I didn't identify with her. First of all, I think it's written for someone a little younger than we all are. It's written for someone who's, you know, a teenager or 22 or 25 and sort of figuring out, like, sort of in the messy phase and needing someone to say, no, you can like have this messy phase and it'll be okay. You don't have to be Sheryl Sandberg and like be an aerobics instructor at Harvard and then have Larry Summers be your mentor in order to succeed. But one criticism that I saw on Twitter among people who had read the New York Magazine article and were discussing it was that she doesn't really address the act of actually being a boss so much. And when she does, she sort of says, you know, like, oh, you can be a boss and be a weirdo. I don't like small talk. I'm not a typical boss. And part of that is like men in that position don't feel like they have to be good at small talk maybe, or they don't have to be like warm and cuddly and kind. But there's an anecdote she tells in the book about, it's in a chapter on, you know, don't waste your money on silly consumer shit, which great. Like, that's fun to hear from someone who has built her, her brand on selling silly consumer shit to women. But she tells us
$100 million in annual sales.
It's crazy.
$50 million in funding from Index Ventures.
And she owns
30 years old.
Yeah, 30 years old, owns like the majority of that, I believe. But she's telling a story about how she furnished her office with IKEA, and she went away for her first vacation in 2011, like ever, maybe, you know, or since starting her business. She finally took a week and a half off. She came back, and one of her employees, who I assume was tasked with sort of, you know, decorating the office, had ordered Herman Miller Aeron chairs for the office. And she herself had one in her office, but she bought it with her own money. And so she made this employee or some other employee sell all of the chairs on Craigslist, the nice chairs on Craigslist. And she told it as a, you know, like, be frugal kind of thing. And I actually had a reaction like, I don't know. I think like, yeah, you did buy it with your own money, but you're literally saying to your employees, I am better than you all are. My ass will sit in a better chair than yours. And like, this mistake was made. Like, this guy probably shouldn't have like gone over the budget, but now you are going to like, we're going to sell these all on Craigslist because these are too nice for you guys. And it just struck me that there was like a little bit of unkindness in that. And maybe a boss does not need to be kind. Like, the boss needs to worry about the bottom line. But that, were I an employee, I might have sort of been like, well, that's not a good look, Sophia. Like, that's not super kind. But I might be over, again, I haven't finished the book. I don't know. But I would be interested to read a book by her in 5 or 10 years when she has, like, that's not just about getting to the place, but about sort of how you operate in that space, how you make that sustainable, how you, like, deal with the day-to-day stuff of managing.
And also, if her meteoric rise continues in 5 or 10 years, I would love to read employees' accounts of working for her, because mm-hmm. I'm not done reading the book either. I've only skimmed it. I've read the profiles and the interviews, and I don't have a sense of what it's like to work for her. I suppose you couldn't at this point. But in terms of setting her up in opposition to the sort of warm, maternal figure that Sheryl Sandberg has affected, and talk about knowing how to brand yourself, mm-hmm. Sheryl Sandberg, yep. and not to insinuate that there's only room for two different kinds of women bosses, but hashtag girl boss versus hashtag band bossy does seem intentional. Yep. So if we are going to look at this opposition directly, one of the things that is so exhausting about reading Lean In is that so much is about something that we were talking about before, which is sort of emotional management of your affect, how you're coming across. Mm. Be bold, but not too bold. Be assertive, but not too assertive. Talk in meetings, but not too much. Amanda Hess has skewered this very ably in the pages of Slate, this sort of Goldilocks hair splitting of how you're coming across. And Sophia Amoruso, so far as I can tell from what I've read about her, cuts through all of that. Like, Sheryl Sandberg's relentless work ethic, so much of that work is thinking about how you're presenting yourself and having this sort of meta relationship to what you're saying and how you're saying it. Sophia Amoruso thinks that all of that hard work can be cast aside by just hard work. Hard mm-hmm. work transcends all of that. She doesn't like small talk. She doesn't like schmoozing. I mean, she got really bored at TED, which I think is a sign of good character.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, she's just not interested. And that could possibly make her a very simple boss to work for. Like, maybe people have a very straightforward, uncomplicated relationship with her. They always know where they stand. They don't have to worry about reading the tea leaves. Or maybe that makes her a nightmare to work for. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But her presentation of how a woman can present herself and succeed in the workplace is more refreshing to me than Sheryl Sandberg's. And it's worth saying that she created a workplace from the ground up. Sheryl Sandberg never did that. Sheryl Sandberg leaned into a business culture, and Sophia Amoruso, for better or worse, we'll find out, created one. That right there puts her a little bit ahead of Sheryl Sandberg in terms of who I want to read a book from.
Yeah,
totally. And the book is actually, we should add, pretty well written for a self-help business book. Like, it's a page turner. She's, she's a character.
One reason that I'm not in love with Sophia Amoruso is her attitude to the word feminist. She does not call herself a feminist. And in one of the profiles that I read, she said that she rejects anything that the feminists at the bookstore in Portlandia would believe in, which saddens me so much because A, it's not real. And B, it's my least favorite bit of art since the Three Yorkshiremen sketch in Monty Python, because it's just an excuse to laugh at people that you actually should respect. And it just misrepresents women who work in feminist bookstores are not humorless. They're just really hardworking.
June, can you come clean here? Didn't you work in a feminist bookstore?
Yes, I did. But here's the thing.
There was a cool feminist bookstore.
There has rarely been a cool feminist bookstore, but that's not the point. I just think she is really buying into some old stuff, old ideas there. And I suspect, too, that it's part of her branding approach. I mean, I don't know. I shouldn't be cynical about her. I don't know. Maybe she truly does have that feeling. But that just was, I kind of made me shake my head and be disappointed in my girl Sophia.
Well, so I didn't read that passage as her rejecting the label feminism exactly. Maybe I just read too quickly. But it's sort of another version of her rejecting the Sheryl Sandberg, spend so much time mediating myself and thinking about whether I'm doing it mm-hmm. right. She's saying, I reject it on the other side too. I reject you know, I don't want to spend time thinking about, am I doing right by other women? Am I like doing this and like by the book? She's just saying, no, I want to do what I want to do and I want to do it how I want to do it. And to me, that is feminism. I mean, she's almost exactly my age and I'm sure we have the same whatever wave of feminism. But I thought that was kind of refreshing. She was like, no, I want to have a really wonderful office job that I'm really committed to. And I also want to dress this way and I don't see a difference between it and I don't want to waste my time parsing what wave of feminism I'm on because I'm just getting things done.
Well, I wish we had the quote right in front of us because she says something about how, you know, it's better, it's more, it shows more of a work ethic if you're getting dressed up and you're paying attention to your hair and your makeup. I think she actually uses the phrase looking sexy. And you're keeping your boyfriend in line. And, you know, she has this whole litany of things that you do when you are embodying the kind of womanhood or girlhood that she espouses. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, I sympathize with her rejecting any kind of doctrinaire idea of what a woman should be. But on the other hand, I don't think that that should then be replaced by another doctrinaire idea of what a woman should be, especially when you're opposing your doctrinaire idea of what a woman should be to Fred Armisen in drag.
Exactly.
In a skit on IFC. I think it just shows a little bit of maybe a lack of a sense of history on her part of what feminism or a feminist can look like or be in any given era of time. And that might be something that matures, you know, in her as she gets older. She's only, I mean, she's so young. She's 30 years old and she's been through a lot and she has a long road ahead of her, I think, in terms of her consciousness.
But she's not wrong to say that the way you dress yourself in the workplace sends out a message about you, and whether you want that message to be sexy or feminist bookstore, she's not wrong to point that out. That's what her business is based on. We might wish that were not the case, but I mean, Jessica, you are dressed very nicely. You are dressed like a senior editor at Slate magazine. I feel like you probably thought a little bit at some point, maybe you have a uniform that you just wear, but when you were selecting your clothes in the store, you thought about whether your self-presentation, I would assume. You're staring at me like, no, I didn't.
I don't know what I think about when I'm buying clothes. This is a whole other fascinating conversation. Listeners should know, I wear a dress every single day of my life.
Really?
I own two pair of jeans. I own no pants. I can look deep inside myself and honestly say it's not for anything other than comfort. It's what I'm most comfortable in. And I'm fortunate that what I'm most comfortable in happens to be this, like, you know, working woman drag. But I, you know, if I were most comfortable in a t-shirt and jeans, I hope I would wear that. I don't know. It's all very convenient.
But why are you comfortable in that?
Let's talk about me. Let's talk about Jessica Winter and her psyche.
I'm making an example of you. But I do think we dress to inhabit roles. I think she's not wrong to say that. I dress to inhabit roles. I mean, I'm dressed like a slob today, but the role I'm inhabiting today is someone on deadline, you know?
The role I inhabit is, does this fit? Great.
All right. Maybe we'll come back to this someday.
We'll come back to it when Sophie Amoruso buys a publication and we're all struggling to get jobs at that same publication.
Wearing a dress every day is super underrated. It's like wearing a nightgown to work and no one can tell.
I'm very pro dresses. All right, we'll have to devote an entire show to what we wore.
Exactly. We'll have to do a wardrobe dump. Okay. Let's move on to our recommendations. Jessica, what do you have?
I want to recommend a poem. It's a poem by Robin Schiff. Robin Schiff wrote one of my favorite books of poetry in recent years. It's called Revolver. And the highest recommendation I can give of that book is that I read it for the first time on a boat off the Caribbean coast of Mexico, and I was getting terribly nauseous because I wasn't looking at the horizon line. Instead, I could not stop looking down at this book. Mm-hmm. So that's my blurb for Revolver by Robin Schiff, a book so good it transcends seasickness. Robin Schiff has a poem up at the Penn Foundation site called The House Lights, and one can never really summarize a poem, but mm-hmm. I can tell you that it encompasses Macbeth and Sputnik and the existential question of what it means to be entertained, and it's haunting and strange and elusive, and it really sticks with you. So again, it's called The House Lights. It's at the Penn Foundation site. We'll put a link up to it on our show page, and it's by the poet Robin Schiff.
And that show page, once again, is slate.com/XX. I'm going to recommend a show on MTV, Faking It, which is a high school show, which I love high school shows. And this one started in a way that made me kind of nervous. I wasn't sure if it was going to be terribly exploitive, which would not have been a good thing, I just want to point out, because the premise of this show is that two girls who, it has to be said, are incredibly attractive, height, weight, proportionate white girls in Austin, Texas, fake being a lesbian couple to achieve popularity in high school, which just seemed to be a very suspect premise and also an opportunity to have all kinds of, you know, soft focus girls making out scenes, which, you know, it really does have quite a lot of. And at first I was, you know, very suspicious of it. But actually, although it does do those things, and although I'm, yes, cynical about the reason that there are quite so many girl makeout scenes, in more recent episodes, there actually have been some kind of reflections that have really been quite profound about thinking that you have a lesbian daughter. So this couple who are faking being lesbians, one of them possibly, probably is indeed a lesbian, and she really is in love with her best friend. And the way that her mom treats her, as opposed to her, not exactly yet stepsister, but more or less, who is heterosexual, is actually something that's very perceptively treated and so on. So it's actually surprising me with the depth of the way that it's exploring this topic. And it's also really quite a funny high school show. And it is paired with Awkward, which is a good pairing for it. So Faking It on MTV is my recommendation. Noreen, what do you want us to read, watch, or listen to this week?
Well, I, for a while, have been on a real kick of like reading books about career gals in New York City from the mid-century, the last century. Anyway, so in that spirit, I want to recommend The Best of Everything by Rona Jaffe. Have you guys read this book?
No.
It's like, you know, if it came out today, it would probably be characterized as chick lit, but it's good. It's like, it follows some girls who work in book publishing in the 1950s, and they sort of are getting wise to the ways of the world. They're, you know, 20 and 22 when it starts out. And she's a very good writer, like very good writer. But she, I kind of love this. This is very Sofia Amoroso of her. She set out to write the book. She was working in publishing, and she said, I'm going to write a book that's going to be turned into a movie. And it was, starring Joan Crawford. Anyway, it's a very good book. I think it's sort of considered a classic of that genre and era. If you're into that kind of thing, Rona Jaffe's The Best of Everything.
Awesome. That's the end of our show for this week. Thank you to Mike Vuolo for producing this week's podcast. Thanks to our new intern, Laura Smith. We're very happy to have you, Laura. We would like to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Please remember to send your comments to xxgabbest@slate.com. For Jessica Winter and Noreen Malone, I'm June Thomas, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.